content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 8, 2025, as usual. The front cover border is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering. It's in, I'd say a gray to beige to tan coloration superimposed over more tan. There's a wall in the background of this cover image. It's cracked. It's in a mustard gold tan color. But seated on the floor in front of the wall, and the floor looks like carpeting. It's brightly colored in red and a white and blue pattern. There's a woman seated. I think she's on her knees, but she may have seated herself all the way to the floor. She is wearing a brown and black plaid dress with a beautiful dark red bordered in gold and black headscarf. It's quite a large scarf, a shawl size. Behind her is a stack of fabric. I don't know if it's fabric on the bolt or if it's folded blankets and quilts and other items, but in bright colors at the bottom, purple and red and yellow, and upwards it becomes somewhat muted. There's one item that's in a almost a dotted design, but the dots are square. It's in neutral colors like taupe and beige, and that repeats itself in a drapery over a tiny baby crib. It's a little baby cradle crib on the floor next to the woman. It looks quite primitive, but it's festooned with bows and ribbons, and there's a baby inside. It's looking at the camera, as is the woman. The baby seems to be swathed or bundled in, again, bright colors of blue and purple. The baby has very dark hair. We do not see what the woman's hair is, but they both have very bright brown eyes. The article that I will lead with is The View, Politics, Poor Vote, Swing Vote, by William J. Barber II and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. On the one hand, this is the worst of times. Power is concentrated in the hands of people who pray at the opening of Congress. Then pray, the first pray is P-R-A-Y, the then pray is P-R-E-Y, on the people they swore an oath to serve. But a close look at voter demographics suggests a small percentage of poor voters who understand what they are losing have the potential to upend American politics. One of the authors, William J. Barber II, is president of Repairers of the Breach and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Wilson Hartgrove is author of Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. North Carolinians may remember Reverend William J. Barber as being newsworthy. Over the past four decades, as inequality has grown exponentially for all Americans, the number of poor and low-income white people, 66 million in 2018, has swelled higher than any other demographic. This is one reason low-income, majority white, communities became susceptible to the populist appeal of the MAGA movement. If white people are hurting, the divide-and-conquer myth suggests it must be because black people or immigrants are taking from them. By leaning into an aggressive investment in extreme ICE raids, President Donald Trump's administration has bet the farm on this myth. But the reality of American politics is that despite these appeals, most poor people do not vote against their own interests. While Trump improved in 2024 among low-income voters who cast a ballot in the election, new data from Lake Research Associates makes clear the real change was in the number of poor and low-income people who decided not to vote in the race between Trump and Kamala Harris. More than 19 million who helped elect President Joe Biden in 2020 did not show up in 2024. Nearly a third said their number one reason for not voting was that they did not feel as if the Democrats' message spoke to their economic situation. Poor people are not driving the extremism in American politics, nor are they the true base for Trump, whose major policy achievement has been to cut government programs that serve everyday people so he can give tax breaks to corporations and wealthy Americans. Poor and low-income Americans are, in fact, the largest swing vote in the country. We need a movement to engage poor people who have not voted because they have never imagined the system could work for them. As they begin to feel the impact of the cuts from Trump's big budget bill, poor and low-income people must organize to demand candidates who will represent them. Movements that bring poor people together across lines of race and region can build on America's history of moral fusion movements to strengthen democracy for all of us. In our book, White Poverty, we wrote about how the 2018 midterms saw a roughly 10% increase in voter participation over the previous midterms, a larger four-year increase than the one that led to Barack Obama's record-breaking turnout in 2008. Many factors contributed to this surge in participation, but a raw number increase in low-income voters made a significant contribution to the blue wave that returned control of the U.S. House to Democrats in 2018 and put a check on Trump's use of the White House to reward elite interests and undermine policies that lift poor people in 2020. A movement can change how candidates talk and what agenda they promise to pursue when elected. Democrats need a new wave of leadership that not only articulates a vision for how government can serve everyday people, but also demonstrates they're committed to use executive action, change courts, and use power to win policies that lift from the bottom so everyone can rise. If a moral fusion movement led by poor and low-income people can rise up in America today, we have the numbers to change the political conversation. This is why we have launched Moral Mondays across the South in districts that will be hurt first and worst by cuts to health care, and organized people who will be directly affected to speak directly to their representatives with clergy and moral leaders by their side. A movement led by these people linking arms across racial lines and joining hands with progressive allies could decide not only the presidential elections, but also many congressional and statewide races. Poor and low-income people make up a third of the U.S. electorate. More than 40% of the electorate in the swing states that will decide the 2026 midterms. It is time for poor people of every race to reject the myths that have been used to divide us and come together to demand an economy that works for all of us. Such a movement is not only good news for the poor, it is the best hope for American democracy. The View essay, World. In Exile, I Lost India, but Gained a Home, by Atish Taseer, T-A-S-E-E-R. This is excerpted from A Return to Self, Excursions in Exile by Atish Taseer, copyright 2025 by Atish Taseer, reprinted by permission of Catapult Books. November 7, 2019, the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked my overseas citizenship of India, OCI, effectively banning me from the country I grew up in. India was where my mother and grandmother lived, where four out of my five books of fiction and nonfiction were set, where I had returned after college in the U.S. with the aim of being an Indian writer. The government alleged I had concealed that my father was Pakistani. It was a surprising accusation. My first book, Stranger to History, A Son's Journey Through Islamic Lands, which was published in 2009, dealt extensively with my relationship to my absent father and my rediscovery of him. I had written countless articles on the subject, not to mention my father was a public figure. In 2011, as governor of Punjab, Pakistan's largest province, he was assassinated by his own bodyguard for defending a Christian woman accused of blasphemy. His killing was on the front page of the New York Times. None of this affected my position in India, where I lived for over 30 years. I became Pakistani the day I wrote a story for the cover of Time titled India's Divider in Chief, which appeared in 2019 in the run-up to Modi's re-election. Modi's army of internet trolls came after me with threats, abuse, and digital vandalism. Then Modi himself spoke, "Time magazine is foreign." The writer has also said he comes from a Pakistani political family. That is enough for his credibility. After that, I was on borrowed time. There is something debilitating about losing one's country. It is so intimately tied up with our sense of self that we do not know how fundamental it is till it's gone. "I do not love Germany," wrote Sebastian Hoffner in 1939 in defying Hitler soon after leaving Nazi Germany for Britain, "just as I do not love myself. But one's country," he continued, "plays a different and far more indispensable role than that of a mistress. It is just one's country. If one loses it, one almost loses the right to love any other country." My relationship to India was instinctive. It formed the understructure of my creative life, a kind of zero point from which I measured my distance to all other places. I could enumerate the reasons why I was Indian, but the beauty of belonging is that it is unspoken. To make the case for why one belongs is, as with certain fundamental rights, to articulate what one never meant to surrender. I was the result of a love affair between an Indian journalist and a Pakistani politician. The affair and my birth out of wedlock shocked my conservative Sikh grandparents. Yet my maternal grandparents embraced me, and my mother, soon after my father, abandoned us. It was my nanny who brought me on her back to India when I was two, and her unquestioning love that instilled in me my sense of place and belonging. Modi's action against me felt like a betrayal of that love. Her husband, my grandfather, was an officer in the Indian Army and had fought against Pakistan in two wars. I thought of how outraged she would be to learn that the child who had grown up in her house had been recast as an enemy alien. She died last year, in 2024, with me unable to see her in her final years. India is lost to me in one sense. I cannot go home. But it is lost to countless others in another, more important sense, too. In India, the demands of blood and soil are now pitted against the exalted idea of a more secular country. India's founders, after the country's 1947 partition along religious lines, were determined never to let it become a Hindu Pakistan. Its first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, envisioned India as a palimpsest, where layer upon layer of thought and reverie had been inscribed, yet no succeeding layer has completely hidden or erased what has been written previously. For men like Nehru and Mohandas Gandhi, the modern nation was to be a repository of the dizzying multiplicity of cultures, languages, religions, and ethnicities that had permeated Indian soil for 5,000 years. India was a collage of states, each the size of a large European country, with languages, scripts, and literatures of its own. It was held together not by the domination of a single group, but rather by its asymmetries. The centrifugal forces of India are old and powerful, wrote the Mexican writer Octavio Paz in Light of India. They have not destroyed the country because without intending to, they have neutralized one another. Beneath this great Indian variety, there lay an underlying unity. India was 85% Hindu, but it was interestingly not a homogeneity. It was something that had never fully been exploited for political purposes, in part because it was felt India's Hindus had more in common with their regional Muslim and Christian counterparts, of whom there are some 170 million and 28 million respectively, than they did with each other. The idea of a Hindu vote, like a white vote in the U.S., was regarded as something of a chimera. This is simply no longer true. Modi's triumph as a politician is that he's been able to galvanize India's roughly 1 billion Hindus behind the notion of India as a holy land. Long before Donald Trump and his MAGA acolytes, Modi understood how the primal power of blood could be deployed against the delicate bloom of ideas and abstractions. His success at remaking India as an ethno-national entity has left many who believed in Nehru and Gandhi's vision of India as what used to be described in the Soviet era as internal emigres, those who were physically present but culturally exiled. Exile is a writer's natural state, the author Jeet Tayil told the Indian press when asked about what the Indian government had done to me. It is a romantic idea, bringing to mind so many writers and painters from James, Nabokov, Joyce, Goya, Chagall, Dali, who were fed as artists by the experience, now imposed, now voluntary, of not being able to return home. But for each of these artists, there are countless others who lack the inner resources needed to be away so long from their friends and family, not to say their material, and for whom exile is arid and sterile. It cannot be said they prospered here, writes Hisham Matar in his novel My Friends, describing the state of Arab intelligentsia in the UK. If anything, they withered, grew old and tired. London was, in a way, where Arab writers came to die. I was not sure what exile would do to me, but as the reality of not being able to go home set in, an unexpected emotion crept over me, relief. The burden of trying to fit into India, of forever apologizing for its shortcomings, apologizing for my own westernization, was suddenly lifted from me. My husband, whom I met in New York in the summer of 2014, after the election that brought Modi to power, remembers how strenuous my assertions of belonging were at the time. The more I stressed my Indian-ness, the more he doubted it was real. As someone who had grown up in evangelical Tennessee and come to live on the East Coast, he was suspicious of claims of authenticity, whether they be of the real India or the real America. Don't forget, he once told me of his folks back home, that as much as we live in a bubble here, they live in a bubble too. The demands of belonging that India made on me must have been hard on my husband, not just my absences, but also my need to forever balance two societies in my head. I remember him asking me once to unpack, to not live as if my life in America were provisional. Then suddenly, one day, I woke up to find it was the only life I had. Once India closed behind me, I felt strangely free. I felt my old curiosities return, many of which I had discarded, in order to better belong in India. I could revel, for instance, in my love of the English language, the locus of so much post-colonial anxiety in India, without fearing that I was somehow letting down the side. The West, in turn, was no longer some dirty secret I could enjoy only at the detriment of the real India. After all the wringing of wrists, the stewing over questions of place, of feeling myself forever betwixt and between, I found I was easier in my own skin. I no longer felt answerable to an imagined country out there whose claims on realness exceeded my own. My circumstances had forced a natural cosmopolitanism on me, and I was not prepared to sacrifice that for anyone. I was home. Turning the page to the View inbox, Health Matters by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. The idea of sleeping on a problem and seeing if you can get some clarity in the morning is a common one, but is it scientifically sound? A growing body of research says yes. The latest is a small study published in the Journal of Neuroscience. A group of 25 people did a memorization task while wired up so the researchers could monitor which portions of their brains lit up as they worked. Everyone then took an afternoon nap with brain sensors still in place. The researchers were looking for bursts of activity that occur in the brain during a relatively light stage of sleep. It was especially high in the same areas of the brain that were used in the memorization task, and the greater the activity, the more people improved at the task when they tried it after the nap. Alyssa Sinclair, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, found something similar in a study published last year. After sleeping on a difficult task, people were more level-headed the next day. When we waited, when we let them sleep on it, they made somewhat more rational choices, she says. This is due largely to the region of the brain known as the hippocampus, which is responsible for processing short-term memories and, during sleep, helping to determine which of those memories will be transferred to long-term storage and which will essentially be deleted. When we're asleep, says Sinclair, the hippocampus is hard at work consolidating those memories and experiences from throughout the day. It does this by replaying things that were important and pruning away the things that were not. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. In normal times, the first Friday of the month brings a routine tranche of government data known as the monthly jobs report. The markets react, the politicians preen, and most Americans go about their day. But these are not normal times. and the Bureau of Labor Statistics is no longer in the safe zone of nonpartisanship, thanks to President Donald Trump's decision to can its chief because he did not like the math. August 1, Trump summarily fired BLS Commissioner Erica McEntarfer, that's McEntarfer, after her team of stats mavens revised downward the job numbers for May and June. Trump decided the revisions were an effort to embarrass him and stoked conspiracy theories of rigged spreadsheets. It was the equivalent of firing a National Weather Service meteorologist because he spotted a hurricane and said something about it. This is about much more than a headcount of Americans showing up to work. The BLS, an independent shop inside the Department of Labor that's run by a Senate-confirmed geek, is a warehouse of quants whose products shape everything from interest rates and investment payouts to strategic decisions made by individual businesses. The BLS is an army of 2,000 nerds whose huge but quiet sway over the global economy is based in large part on the confidence that they do not cook the books. September 5. The federal government is scheduled to release its first jobs report since Trump fired McEntarfer. The reaction to those numbers is likely to be colored by her dismissal. If, say, the report shows hiring surge in August, will investors even believe it? Trump's predecessors largely prioritized stability over showmanship. Understanding the importance of projecting a steady hand from Washington since World War II reset the global order. Many of Trump's capricious choices, from his trade and tariff war tantrums to his repeated threatening to fire the Federal Reserve chairman, are undermining that perception. Many global leaders now see U.S. influence as shrinking, as so many of the country's decisions seem to have no obvious aim other than serving Trump's lust for chaos and affirmation. Around Washington, the daily whiplash has become routine, but the BLS shift is something new, even though presidents might not always like the report that crosses their desk each month. They could have confidence they were getting an accurate as possible snapshot of the economy. The same can be said for Wall Street, which counts on the ledger to be an apolitical indicator. Good data help not just the Fed, it helps the government and also helps the private sector, said Fed Chair Jay Powell 2 days before McEntarfer was sacked. The United States has been a leader in that for 100 years. Trump's impetuous act constitutes a huge risk, one that historically has never worked out. The Greek debt crisis that began in 2009 was the result of a Potemkin set of books. Argentina's 2001 default on international loans was the byproduct of fictional inflation numbers. In 1937, Joseph Stalin had his census chief shot and killed when his numbers contradicted what the Soviet leader advertised. The unflattering numbers were buried in the Soviet archives until 1989. Trump has long fetishized such strongman bravado, but he also craves the approval of Wall Street, which has a thing for accurate, stable, honest data, an indispensable service Washington produced for decades with little drama. Time CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Warland, Senior Correspondent. It is hard to think of a policy move that could more directly target the core of climate science than the Trump administration's July 29 decision to undo the Environmental Protection Agency's endangerment finding, reached by the EPA in 2009, it outlines how greenhouse gas emissions threaten public health and welfare, thereby laying out the legal basis for the agency to regulate those pollutants. The finding is the linchpin of EPA climate regulation, affecting everything from automobiles to power plants. Successfully undoing it would help the administration swiftly reverse a slew of climate rules. The Department of Energy also released an accompanying report launching a full frontal assault on the scientific consensus on climate change. In the hours that followed, my inbox filled with statements decrying the move as devastating and reckless for understandable reasons, but the precise effects are difficult to predict. For one, it is not immediately obvious that the rollback will survive the litigation that will challenge it, even with an increasingly conservative judiciary. One reason is the faulty scientific basis for the decision. Another is the legal precedent established in the 2007 Massachusetts v. EPA decision, which gave the agency the authority to regulate greenhouse gases if they endanger public health. Finally, Congress included language in the Inflation Reduction Act that clarified greenhouse gas emissions count as pollutants. That language remains even after Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill gutted the law. In the years that litigation plays out, companies will be left in a state of confusion. Will they ultimately have to comply with some version of existing regulations if courts do not side with the Trump administration? Will a future administration impose even more stringent regulations? Will states come up with regulations of their own? Longer term, expect a whole constellation of factors, from tighter regulation in foreign markets to technology developments, to provide an incentive for lower emission technologies. At some point, perhaps, Congress might even craft legislation that gives more direct guidance on how the EPA should regulate greenhouse gases. I do not say any of this to diminish the decision's weight. It is certainly significant that as the costs of climate change become more evident, the U.S. government would make such an egregious attack on climate science. Nonetheless, EPA regulations are not the primary driver pushing companies to decarbonize. Large companies are subject to regulations globally. Technological advances mean energy systems are, in general, getting cleaner and greener because of economics. Nixing the endangerment finding is a roadblock, but it is not the end of the story. Last page, 8 questions. Laufey, L-A-U-F-E-Y, the Grammy-winning, genre-blending musician, on pushing herself creatively, making her latest album, and confiding in Nora Jones. Erin McMullen writes this in the question-answer format. There is a lot of talk about how exactly to label your music, jazz or pop. Does that ever get annoying? Answer. I wouldn't say it's annoying, but I think it's reductive. I've never felt like one thing or another. That was the biggest difference for this album. I didn't think about genre. I was like, my genre is Laufey. This is a Laufey album. Again, Laufey is spelled L-A-U-F-E-Y. Question, you've said the songs on your new album, A Matter of Time, came right from your diary. What made you want it to get so personal? Answer, I had the confidence to. I also fell in love for the first time, so it's an album about that and the self-discovery that comes with it. The whole goal of the album is to illustrate the contrast between this glass-like beauty and chaos that I feel within myself so often, that I'm needing to present myself in a very pristine way, but I'm fighting some sort of chaos on the inside because I'm not letting it out. With this album, I really just wanted to let it all out. Question, was that the inspiration for the cacophonous instrumentals on Sabotage, the last song on the record? Answer, Sabotage is where the album title comes from, and it's kind of the thesis. It's about the fight between your external and your internal. It's about the fear of sabotaging something beautiful and of another person finding out your true nature. So with those instrumental disturbances, I wanted to interpret anxiety and the noise in your head that kind of blurs everything out. Question, Forget Me Not is a love letter to Iceland, where you're from. What does that song mean to you? Answer, it's about trying to balance two cultures and the fear of losing the one you moved away from. It's something that really plagues me all the time. Am I Icelandic enough now that I've lived away from Iceland for 7 years? So I wanted to tell Iceland, sorry, I had to leave to go chase my dreams, and I wanted to hide it within a love letter because in some ways it sounds like I'm singing about a person. There's something beautiful about that to me because it kind of does feel like a long-distance relationship. Question, on Snow White, you sing about the unfair beauty standards women are often held to. Why was it important for that song to make it onto the album? Answer, I wrote it out of frustration for not being able to reach or achieve these standards that are set for women that tour arenas or walk red carpets. Striving for perfection is a dark, endless road because the goalposts keep moving. Question, I think even women who are not in the industry can relate, right? Answer, we all have these impossible standards thrust upon us, and we all have those moments where we feel like the way we look is way important, way more important than how we speak. I thought so much about putting this song out because I'm aware of my position as a role model and I'm aware of my words being listened to by young people, but I realized that sometimes feeling seen or relating to someone is the best feeling. Question, who do you talk to when you want to feel seen? Answer, I love dumping my problems on Nora Jones. I don't know what it is. I think her voice is just so comforting. Claro is incredible. I love talking to her. Olivia Rodrigo, she's just so balanced and beautiful and kind. Conan Gray as well. Anytime I need to get anything out of my system, Conan is the first person I call. Last question. A Matter of Time is your third album. How do you think you grew as an artist with this project? Answer, lyrically, I really let myself be incredibly honest and not think too much about how it was going to be perceived by the world. I really tried to create something unique. I did not think too much about what box the album was going to fit into. I did not want to be held back, so I just kind of let myself be free. From the Time Off calendar, the fall preview, which I will not read in its entirety. Books, movies, TV shows, albums, we will be talking about all season by Ben Rosenstock, Lucy Ford, and Shannon Carlin. So this is, it's all gathered together, music, books, television, movies, and it's color-coded in the print, so I need to pay attention to this. September. Television, 18th, Black Rabbit, Jude Law and Jason Bateman, play two brothers, one a successful restaurateur and the other a black sheep who brings drama when he re-enters his sibling's life, Netflix. The 19th of September, music, Am I the Drama? Cardi B's long-anticipated second studio album is set to include 23 tracks recorded over the past 6 years, during which time she had 3 children and a very public divorce. Television, the 23rd, The Lowdown, Reservation Dogs co-creator Sterling Harjo, or Harho, follows a Tulsa, Oklahoma journalist, Ethan Hawke, unraveling a web of corruption. FX. On the 26th, the movie One Battle After Another. Paul Thomas Anderson teams up with Leonardo DiCaprio for an action thriller inspired by Thomas Pynchon's 1919 novel Vineland, shifting its story of revolutionaries forward in time. On the 30th, television Chad Powers. Glenn Powell stars in this comedy, loosely based on the experiences of Eli Manning when he went undercover at Penn State football tryouts, Hulu. And on the 30th, a book, Heart the Lover. Lily King's sixth novel looks at a love triangle, lingering consequences, as college paramours reunite decades later. October the 3rd, music. The life of a showgirl, Taylor Swift describes her 12th studio album as having stemmed from the most infectiously joyful, wild, traumatic place I was in my life. On the 3rd of October, a movie, The Smashing Machine. Dwayne Johnson is almost unrecognizable in Benny Softee's biopic about former MMA fighter Mark Kerr. On the 24th of October, a movie, Bugonia, Yorgos Lanthimos reteams with Emma Stone for a comedy in which two conspiracy theorists, Jesse Plemons and Aidan Delbus, kidnap a CEO, Stone, convinced she's an alien trying to destroy the planet. The 28th of October, Dead and Alive, a book. Zadie Smith finds light amid darkness by focusing on artists she admires, including Carol Walker, Joan Didion, Kate Blanchett, and Hilary Mantel. Moving into November the 4th, a book, Book of Lives. Margaret Atwood's memoir is a travelogue through her life and career, from a nomadic childhood, often spent in the wild forest of northern Quebec, to her novels and activism. Also on the 4th, another book, Bread of Angels. 15 years on from the award-winning Just Kids, Patti Smith releases her fourth autobiography, following her rise from an imaginative working-class kid to a punk rock icon. On the 6th of November, television, All Her Fault, Successions. Sarah Snook plays a mother who goes to pick up her son from a playdate, only to be greeted by someone who claims never to have heard of him. Peacock. November 7, another television, Pluribus. Vince Gilligan, creator of two of the greatest shows of the prestige TV era, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, returns with a sci-fi drama also set in Albuquerque, starring Saul's Rhea Seehorn, Apple TV Plus. On the 13th of November, television, The Beast in Me. A reclusive, grieving author, Claire Danes, becomes obsessed with her new neighbor, Matthew Reese, a real estate mogul once suspected in his wife's disappearance. Netflix. On the 21st of November, a movie, Wicked for Good. Following last year's cliffhanger, For Good picks up on the friendship between Elphaba, Cynthia Erivo, and Glinda, Ariana Grande, as it faces new challenges 5 years later. And on the 27th of November, another movie, Hamnet, H-A-M-N-E-T. Chloe Zhao worked with Maggie O'Farrell to adapt the latter's 2020 novel that imagines Shakespeare, Paul Mescal, and his wife Agnes, Jessie Buckley, grieving the death of their young son. Time off review, television, by Judy Berman, A Family in Full. The conventions of the animated family sitcom have not changed much in the 36 years since The Simpsons set the template for shows like King of the Hill, Family Guy, Bob's Burgers. True to the cartoon medium, the characters are outsize and their adventures over the top. And in a custom that has been key to their longevity, time does not really pass from season to season, unencumbered by the growing or deteriorating bodies of human actors, these series are set in an eternal quasi-present, within which cultural references are constantly updated, yet, with the exception of a recent Hill revival that fast-forwards 8 years, everyone stays around the same age. In Netflix's long story short, BoJack Horseman creator Raphael Bob Waksberg uses the elasticity of animation to warp time in a very different way, dropping in on a singular Jewish family a couple dozen times from the 1990s to 2022 and once in 1959. Funny, idiosyncratic, philosophical, and warm, if occasionally more sentimental than BoJack fans might like, it ties together generation-spanning threads of love and resentment to create an intricate web of characters and relationships. At the center of that web are siblings, Avi Shira and Yoshi Schwooper, whose last name progressively combines those of their father, Elliot Cooper, voiced by Paul Reiser, and mother, Naomi Schwartz, Lisa Edelstein. Eldest son, Avi, Ben Feldman, is introspective, self-righteous, determinedly secular. Anger defines Shira, Abby Jacobson, the middle child. Their much younger brother, Yoshi, Max Greenfield, is the oddball of a family that, as Avi's quiet blonde girlfriend notices in the premiere, was never itself a paragon of laid-back normalcy. As it yokes formative scenes from the Schwooper's youth to vignettes that trace the impact of those moments on their adult lives, story takes up Jewish identity as a central theme. Yiddish words pepper conversations. The Holocaust is never far from anyone's mind. One standout episode recounts Shira's wife Kendra's, Nicole Byer, circuitous conversion to the faith. Competing visions of and attitudes toward Judaism arise. While October 7 falls outside the first season's time frame, story has already been renewed, and I hope it will have the courage in season 2 to probe this fraught era for Jews around the world. Naomi is such an archetypal Jewish mother. Pushy, controlling, critical, passive-aggressive, self-dramatizing, that she often reads as a caricature, but she's also, we eventually discover, its heart. Bob Waksberg has an eye for humorous details that ring true. Paired with a great voice cast and scribbly animation that translates the Schwooper's angst into visual terms, he gives us sly parodies of 90s alt-rock posters on the walls of Avi's boyhood bedroom, a surreal allegory where wolves run loose at a middle school. Lines like, uh-oh, mom's personality is starting. Yet, story also contains the universal meaning of life-level insights that made BoJack a classic and his trippy, under-acknowledged Amazon series Undone just as enthralling. Like those shows, it is fascinated and moved by our subjective experiences of relationships and time and how the stories we tell ourselves about those things make us the people we are. Also by Judy Berman, another television review. Two good men confront the task of forgiveness. this will probably be abbreviated. Crime dramas in our distracted times tend to front-load said crimes. More often than not, there's a murderer within the first 5 minutes. This is only one of the genre's many implicit rules that HBO's Task breaks. The series from Mayor of Easttown creator Brad Inglesby opens with a montage of quotidian scenes from the lives of two men. Weary Tom Brandis, Mark Ruffalo, folds his hands in prayer, dunks his face in a sink full of ice water, downs Advil while driving. Rugged Robbie Prendergast, Tom Pelfrey, carries his sleeping son to bed, pours himself a tall mug of coffee, perks up at a radio ad for a dating app. These tender parallel portraits introduce the characters whose analogous circumstances and divergent choices are, more than any murder or mystery, the show's central subject. Like Mare, but slightly more elegant in its plotting, Task uses the detective story format and the specificity of its rural Pennsylvania setting to explore elemental human problems. Whereas the former revealed the many ways in which the responsibility for keeping families and communities together falls on women, an observation that informs the new series as well, Inglesby's latest makes an astute study of guilt, revenge, and forgiveness. Task's dual protagonists fall on opposite sides of the law. Still hurting a year after his wife left him and their two kids, Robbie works in sanitation with his best friend, Cliff, Raul Castillo. Recently, they've been meeting up at night with a third friend to rob trap houses. The men disguise themselves from targets who might recognize them, mostly members of a biker gang called the Dark Hearts, with Halloween masks. They brandish guns but avoid violence. As far as felonies go, the bloodless armed robbery of drug dealers ranks low on the moral outrage scale until a victim catches a glimpse of one assailant's face. Then, suddenly, Robbie and his boys are murderers. An FBI veteran on career fair recruitment duty in the wake of his wife's death, Tom is tapped to head a task force investigating these crimes, hence the show's bland title. His staff, culled from a hodgepodge of local law enforcement groups, is green, while Anthony Fabian Frankel chats amiably. Aaliyah, the Underground Railroad star Tuso Mbedu, who should really be getting more of this kind of work, is all business. Lizzie, Allison Oliver, a young divorcee, just seems like a mess. Meanwhile, Tom's adopted son Ethan, Andrew Russell, is in jail awaiting trial. Tom and his teenage daughter, Ethan's biological sister, Emily, Sylvia Dionicio, must decide whether to support him in court, despite the unimaginable pain he's caused their family. While the similarities between Tom's and Robbie's lives pile up as the series progresses, the most crucial connections are immediately apparent. Both men are fathers who love their children fiercely, but have come somewhat unmoored since losing their wives. In lieu of criminal activity, Tom drinks too much. In defiance of their respective tough guy roles, both are also preternaturally gentle, thoughtful, vulnerable. That their contradictions cohere into believable personalities is a credit to Ruffalo and especially Pelfrey, whose plaintive delivery of lines like, "I need a life companion," could shatter your heart. There are moments when Task belabors the comparison between its two leads, though never to the extent that Inglesby's ruminations derail a story that only works so well thanks to its richly shaded characters. This is not a tale of good guys versus bad guys. Villains emerge, to be sure, but the real, rarer, and less predictable conflicts are the internal struggles of people whose laudable intentions bump up against desperate situations. This liberates the show from the crime investigation arrest plot arc, typical of this genre, without robbing it of suspense. Episodes are propelled instead by rising tensions around the impossible choices characters must make. It is easy to do the right thing until someone wrongs you. How does a good person respond when someone hurts the people they love? Task subverts expectations without sanctimony. It acknowledges violent criminals can have kind hearts. Law enforcement leaders can be as corrupt as biker gang bosses. And sometimes when something tragic happens, punishing the person who is nominally responsible does not always constitute justice.
Thank you.